Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
Welcome to Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Slavery was introduced in the U.S. over 400 years ago. The legacy of white supremacy continues today, and it's reflected in a centuries-old wealth gap. People of color are historically disenfranchised. Wealth is generally concentrated in the white population. The current pandemic is amplifying racial and economic inequality. The Institute for Policy Studies recently released the report, White Supremacy is the Pre-Existing Condition, 8 Solutions to Ensure Economic Recovery Reduces the Racial Wealth Divide. We're joined today by two authors of the study, Omar Ocampo, researcher for the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, and Chuck Collins, director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good. Collins tells us that wealth discrepancies are built into the racist history of the United States.
Well, I think the racial wealth divide is sort of how the past shows up in the present. It's the way in which the legacy of racism, white supremacy, as it particularly applies to building wealth, saving money, kind of shows up in the bank accounts and in the who owns a home and who doesn't, and in the really quality and well-being of people in the current moment. So whether we go back 400 years or 50 years, you can see how racial discrimination prevented Black and brown people from getting on the wealth-building train while white people were on the express train. That's how it shows up in the present.
Omar, I mean, this is a report with a very eye-catching headline, White Supremacy is the Pre-Existing Condition. And right now, the talk of white supremacy, it's being mentioned more in the news. It's being mentioned more in common conversation. You would talk about white supremacy. You talk about racism. You talk about white nationalism. And it almost seemed before these last few months, it was, oh, maybe the president said something racially tinged. You didn't really want to call it out as racist. Saying something was white supremacist oriented or saying something is flat out racist was something that a lot of people were afraid of actually outright saying. And now we're actually bringing it into the conversation. And so, Omar, can you tell us, is that why you decided to use white supremacy as the pre-existing condition as just sort of that eye-catching headline for this report?
I think it's just, a matter of fact, that, as Chuck said, that, there's this legacy of slavery, of Jim Crow, the war on drugs, all these things are racialized. And I think it's the work of, grassroots movements and organizers and activists who've been doing a lot of work within the past decade to, bring these ideas to the mainstream. So I think this is, just a culmination of things that have been at the grassroots for a while. And we're just, reflecting that as well.
After the El Paso shootings, I spoke with a historian in El Paso who said that once we can accept that our nation was founded on white supremacy, we can actually start having these conversations and sort of start healing these rifts. Do you think that having this conversation about white supremacy and the beginnings of the U.S. is actually going to maybe help close that racial wealth divide you talk about in your report?
I don't think we can overcome or heal from this without facing our history. There's this narrative when it comes to wealth inequality that everybody is where they deserve to be, that the difference between, Omar and I in terms of our wealth is because he gets up earlier and works harder and I don't, whatever the mythology is of deservedness. And that story just renders invisible this history of wealth extraction, wealth taking, and uncompensated labor down the list. So I am hopeful that part of facing our history is what allows us to move forward. in our report is saying, look, here's things that we could do to reduce the racial wealth divide in a generation. If we followed components of this program, I believe we could eliminate this multi-generational inequity. But the first step is obviously to just face the history, understand how it plays out in our individual lives, but also into how it plays out sort of in the sweep of history.
Well, Omar, we're going to get more into the details of the report here shortly, but sort of piggybacking onto what Chuck was just saying, that if you are not making enough money, it's because you're not working hard enough. And I think people of color have had that stereotype. For example, Mexicans, you're lazy Mexicans, they just don't want to work. But yet, who is out there doing all the work right now, especially in this pandemic? All of the essential workers, the ones who are doing the cleaning of everything that you touch, they're cleaning up everything behind you. They're the ones cleaning up the hospitals. They're the ones who are picking your food. People of color are the ones who are really taking this burden upon themselves, and yet they're not making as much money as you would say the overall white population. Can you maybe expand on that thought a little bit more, Omar?
So I always found the idea of, you know, the lazy Mexican to be quite a paradox, because one of the reasons why Mexicans come here is because there's actually a demand for their labor, and they're doing all the essential labor and a lot of labor that a lot of Americans feel that they don't want to do. So, you know, they're, you know, mainly concentrated in construction and, you know, agriculture and the restaurant industry, service industry. And these are all essential. And these are things that, you know, make our economy move and generates economic activity. Unfortunately, they're just not paid according to their productivity. And they're also concentrated in poor neighborhoods. So that, unfortunately, has an effect on their ability to accumulate and build wealth. You know, there's housing segregation and there's less of a tax base in order to give them resources and the infrastructure to help support and building that wealth.
We're talking with Omar Ocampo, researcher for the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, and with Chuck Collins, director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good. They're co-authors of the report, White Supremacy is the Pre-Existing Condition, 8 Solutions to Ensure Economic Recovery Reduces the Racial Wealth Divide. When we come back, efforts by the government to shore up the economy in the pandemic is not closing the wealth gap.
Yeah, unfortunately, a $1,200 check for every adult in the U.S. is not even 2 weeks worth of wages for the average worker, and it most likely got spent in a minute.
More with Omar Ocampo and Chuck Collins next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. U.S. billionaires are making lots of money during the pandemic, while the average worker's wages are on a razor's edge. The Institute for Policy Studies found that between March and June, the combined wealth of all U.S. billionaires increased by $637 billion. That's the equivalent of more than 13% of all Black wealth. According to Business Insider, of the 600-plus billionaires in the U.S., only 6 of them are Black. A racial wealth gap is the legacy of the racist beginnings of the United States. Omar Ocampo and Chuck Collins are co-authors of the report, White Supremacy is the Pre-Existing Condition, 8 Solutions to Ensure Economic Recovery Reduces the Racial Wealth Divide. It's published by the Institute for Policy Studies. Collins says predominantly white billionaire wealth is one example of this pre-existing condition.
Well, Omar and I have been doing reports looking at billionaire wealth under the pandemic. So we were kind of monitoring some of these trends. If you took the top 12 billionaires, their combined wealth is equal to all the home ownership wealth, home equity of all Blacks in the United States, 17 million households. If you took all the U.S. billionaires, all their wealth combined, 640 billionaires, together have about $3.5 trillion in wealth. that is equivalent to the entire Latino population combined, 59 million people. So part of what we're trying to show is there is a historic racial wealth divide, but there is also a recent extreme inequality, extreme upsurge in the concentration of wealth at the very top, and that these statistics show the absurdity of just how much wealth is pooled just among a couple hundred households.
And Omar, I thought it was kind of eye-opening, this other statistic that's in your report. 90% of housing assistance goes to households with an income of $100,000. How is that?
So I think that just reflects that our public policy normally is geared towards people who already have wealth. And this is very unfortunate because at times like this, we need more affordable housing and we need to advance policies that encourage homeownership, since homeownership is essential to building wealth. And it just also reflects that wealth is also power. So if wealth is distributed unequally, then your ability to influence public policy is also distributed unequally. And that is reflected in the fact that a lot of assistance goes to people who already have high incomes or are of high net worth.
Do you think, Chuck, that perhaps the information that comes from the top, the information that's coming from the Trump administration, prior to the pandemic, the economy, he said, was, you know, better than ever. But again, these are words that are coming from people who probably have not known poverty. They've been living with wealth their entire lives. Do you think that the people who are telling us this news about the economy, about how Black people in America have never had it so good, etc., do you think that they have a disconnect because they just cannot relate?
I think there is a disconnect between people who have a tremendous wealth and privilege. There's a disconnect for a lot of white people in just understanding the real dimensions of the racial wealth divide. But what's interesting is, like, since the Great Recession, say 2008, 2009, very few households in the United States, like roughly only 20%, have kind of recovered back to the point they were in, say, 2007, meaning 80% of households kind of had a hangover still from the Great Recession as we entered the pandemic. And for a lot of people, that means living close to the edge. So one out of five households in the U.S. has zero or negative wealth, no reserves to fall back on. And the next 20% have very, very little. And if you look at it through the lens of race, 37% of African-American households, zero or negative wealth. 33% of Latinx households, zero or negative wealth. So that's the pre-existing condition that we're talking about, the fact that people don't have liquidity. They don't have a cushion. It's not just the very poor. We're really talking about the bottom half of U.S. households are struggling. And so it's easy to sort of say, yeah, the economy is doing better, but unemployment is at a historic low. One would hope prior to the pandemic that the middle class would have started to share in the growth of the economy after 40 years of stagnant wages. And that is a good sign. You know, it was good. Finally, wages were starting to rise, but it took a complete intergalactic event of the stars lining up for that to be possible. And then along comes the pandemic. We know that $6.5 trillion of wealth vanished in the first quarter of 2020, according to the Federal Reserve. We know that that was disproportionately low and middle income people who saw that wealth, savings, home equity vanish.
You also point out in your report, and Omar, I'll ask this of you, that billionaires have been seeing their wealth increase since the pandemic began. Can you explain why that is?
So our research shows that a lot of the assets that the billionaire class is tied to the stock market, and the stock market has actually been doing pretty well. After the initial dip, when the pandemic started, like in mid-March, it started trending upwards. So, and I think that some people were well positioned to take advantage of the pandemic. So a company like Amazon or digital platforms, there was an increase in their demand. So therefore, it only makes sense that their value would increase in the stocks. But, you know, to go back to the point about there being a disconnect, the unemployment rate under Trump pre-pandemic was very low, but nearly half the jobs in the United States are all low wage. So even though the stock market is doing great, the economy is doing great, there's goods and services being produced, it's mainly being concentrated at the top because low wages means high profits, and that benefits the stock market.
Yeah, and that's a very good point because, again, after the pandemic, the essential workers were the ones who were actually keeping food on our table. So basically, we were benefiting from people who are out there with no protection, out there with no health insurance, who are risking their health picking our food, growing our crops. So I think that's it's a pretty important point to make. And I also think that just like the 2008 recession, the pandemic, and I think any other sort of major disaster that impacts a country or a state or a locality, you mentioned Katrina in your report, those type of devastating events end up highlighting the discrepancies that you can find between a wealthy white population and people of color who are at the bottom of this ladder. Chuck, can you maybe comment on that a little bit?
I mean, I think that typically a disaster like that kind of pulls back and you see the stark inequalities that underlie the situation. But I think it's important to say it doesn't have to be this way. And I think part of what Omar and I are saying in this report is there's a way to design the recovery to ensure that we don't pull apart further. And in fact, we reverse these historic racial inequalities. It doesn't have to be this way. You know, after coming out of the 2008 economic meltdown, the racial wealth divide was worsened because all the solutions were focused on propping up banks and propping up Wall Street and not helping Main Street small businesses and not helping homeowners stay in their homes. So millions of people lost their home equity, particularly Black, Brown, and Native people lost home equity. If we had had a recovery that was more focused on lifting up the floor and ensuring everybody participated in the economy, we wouldn't have had 10 more years of pulling apart.
I mean, isn't that kind of what the Paycheck Protection Program was, to sort of shore up these smaller businesses? And it turns out that a lot of that money is going to businesses that really were not in as much danger of shutting down as some of the smaller businesses. Omar?
Yeah, unfortunately, $1,200 check for every adult in the U.S. is not even 2 weeks worth of wages for the average worker, and it most likely got spent in a minute. Meanwhile, the government has spent hundreds of billions of dollars to bail out large corporations and purchase $1 trillion of assets and corporate bonds and granted billions of dollars in tax breaks. And I think this idea that if you give money to the wealthy and the corporations, that it will somehow trickle down is false. This money largely gets pocketed. And then we see proof of this with the weekly increase in unemployment.
Well, Chuck, as you were saying, it doesn't have to be this way. And the subtitle of your report is 8 Solutions to Ensure Economic Recovery Reduces the Racial Wealth Divide. So can you tell us what some of those solutions are?
Well, one first sort of phase is just to make sure that the existing government subsidies, the stimulus packages, don't worsen the racial wealth divide. And we recommend that we do a lot better job collecting data on who's benefiting and that we kind of do a racial equity analysis and audit of the various crisis relief and recovery programs. So we know which ones actually worked and which ones reduced the racial wealth gap and which ones made it worse. And then I think from there, there are a couple things. One is we should actually be providing more than just simply a $1,200 stimulus check, but sort of more ongoing income support that maybe eventually transitions to a guaranteed job. So, you know, this whole idea that, you know, we're going to somehow recover from this pandemic, a lot of people will need to stay home. A lot of people will need to social distance and not be in a workplace. So we need to provide support while people are there. We are also advocates of something called postal banking, which is the whole idea of expanding the mandate of the post office to provide minimal financial services like check cashing. Again, it was ridiculous that it took months for the government to find people and get them stimulus funds, money that would have helped the economy if it had been, you know, spent in March, didn't arrive for many people sometimes as late as June, if it arrived at all. And the Postal Service is uniquely set up to help people who are unbanked, who don't have access to traditional bank accounts. It played that role historically. It's in rural and urban communities where there are insufficient banks to start with. So those are a couple, and maybe Omar could mention some of the others.
Yeah, we also advocate for Medicare for all, increasing the supply of affordable housing. We have what we consider like an asset building program, which is called the Baby Bond Program, which is a policy that is supported by Senator Cory Booker, where every newborn is given an account financed and managed by the state, and that the child can access that account once he or she enters adulthood. And then they can use the funds that's in that account to, you know, enhance an asset. So they can put a down payment on a home, or they can use that money to fund their university education, or that can be as startup capital for like a business. So that's how one of the other programs that we support.
Omar Ocampo is a researcher for the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. Chuck Collins is the director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good. They and Diedrich Asante Mohammed are co-authors of the report, White Supremacy is the Pre-Existing Condition, 8 Solutions to Ensure Economic Recovery Reduces the Racial Wealth Divide. A link to the report is at tpr.org. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show online at tpr.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Brie Kirkham. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.